Dear Sugar is supported by
The universe has good news for the lost, lonely, and heartsick. Sugar is here, the both of us, speaking straight into your ears. I'm Cheryl Strayed.
I'm Steve Almond. This is Dear Sugar Radio.
Oh, dear soul, won't you please share some bittersweet days with me? Check my mailbox every day for any sugar you send my way.
Welcome back to another episode of Dear Sugar Radio. Hi, Steve. How you doing?
Cheryl, it is so good to be back in the same airspace with you. I've been thinking about this strange episode as I was reading over the letters for this week. I've been thinking about this strange episode in my life where I went to see Kurt Vonnegut, my literary hero, and he was very frail and old, and it was a very moving experience for me because I'd worshipped him all my life, and it was very clear that he was at the end of his life. And there was a question that when somebody said, Kurt Vonnegut, what is your essential topic? I mean, I think as writers, we sort of dream that somebody will say, like, Cheryl Strayed, what's your essential topic? It's kind of intimidating, but it's also like, what do you have to say to the world? What are you really writing about? And I thought, well, it's Kurt Vonnegut. He's going to say, oh my gosh, you know, the human condition, or the chaos of war, or the cruelty that we inflict on one another, or whether the species is too despicable to survive its own bad behavior, or any of these large bore things that I thought about when I thought about Vonnegut. And in fact, without even pausing, Cheryl, he said, I write again and again about my family. And anybody who knows Kurt Vonnegut, it is shocking because he, like a lot of great fiction writers and novelists, has really concealed his family. But if you read a book like Cat's Cradle, you realize that it's all about his relationship with his older brother, who was a brilliant scientist. And yes, it's about the peril of science and technology and how it may overrun us, but it's also about his relationship with his big brother. And so many of the books, when you trace his biography, are actually writing about family. That's what we're doing, because we move from one family in this world into the same family. No matter how hard we try, they're in our groundwater. They become who we are. And I thought about that as I sort of read over these letters in particular and what they're struggling with.
I would say, you know, if I were asked that question that Kurt Vonnegut was asked, I would say that I write about love, but it's really kind of the same thing. I think love and family, you know, whether that means you got enough of it or if it was good love or bad love, or I think that we're all writing that. It does really make me think about, like, that difference between that family of origin, the place we all came from, and then the place we created. And, of course, those two things can look very similar. I'm always struck by people who grew up and essentially replicated, you know, the family that they came from. I think of my childhood as being one that was full of love, but also full of brokenness, you know, just having divorced parents, not having a relationship with my father for most of my childhood, having my mother die young, and you know, the struggles of poverty and all of the different struggles of my childhood. The center of it was happiness and love and light. And I think that, you know, in the family I've created, that lives on, the core. I feel like I love my children essentially in the same way that I was loved by my mother. And yet everything about my childhood is different from their childhood. I think that essential thing that we carry forward, it can be the joy, it can be the light, or it can be the wounds and the sorrows. And those can be a little bit harder to detect.
Right. We have a letter that I think sort of speaks to that collision in terms of the family that we came from and the family that we create very directly. Let's hear it.
Dear Sugar, my dad is a recovering or perhaps currently relapsing alcoholic. He has violated my trust many times over the years, but the most recent incident was particularly painful. He and my mom were out visiting me right after the birth of my first child, a beautiful baby girl. One evening, I caught him sneaking gin out of my liquor cabinet. After processing what had happened, I asked him to leave. I had the unpleasant sensation of traveling back in time to the years before he went to rehab. Added to that was the fact that this was during such a special and fragile time for me, as I was figuring out how to be a mother to my precious 1-week-old baby. I couldn't believe he would behave how he did at such a time. He is at heart a good man, and I know he wants to be a good father and grandfather, and he has always been his own worst enemy. Given the conversation we had before he left, I know that he understands he has some serious trust to rebuild if he wants to have a good relationship with me and see his granddaughter. Several weeks have gone by, however, and he has not made any overtures to repair the situation. My mom told me he's seeking help, but he has said nothing to me about it. We don't talk on the phone much. Our relationship has never been a very comfortable one, even when he's sober. At this point, what should I do? A big part of me feels like it's up to him to initiate. He created the situation. On the other hand, my dad is in his 70s, and of course, none of us know how long we have on this earth. I have to accept that he will never be the father I want him to be, but he's the only father I have. I'm so tired of being sad and angry about his failings. And I'm so tired of feeling guilty for being sad and angry because of how much he has done for me financially throughout my life and how much I know he loves me. I think part of the challenge here is that I've never truly forgiven him for the hurt he has caused and is still causing my mom, my siblings, and me. And I have no idea how to do that. Where do I go from here, Sugar? Love, tired and confused.
Well, I can see why she's tired and confused. She's a new mom, and she has a dad who shows up at her house. And you remember, Cheryl, what it's like in those earliest weeks where, you know, this is her first child. And she walks into wherever it is, the liquor cabinet, and, you know, he's got her gin in hand. There are two things about this detail that, to me, that are so heartbreaking. One is that he would choose, in a sense, to drink her liquor in her home. And then the other thing that's heartbreaking about that is he's dependent enough and or destructive enough that he sabotages the possibility of this grandparental relationship and the trust that he's trying to rebuild with his daughter. It's just heartbreaking if you think about it, what sort of pressures were awakened in him that in this vulnerable moment in his daughter's life, he would betray her in this way.
Yeah. Well, but nothing to me is surprising about that. And everything to me is heartbreaking about it. You said there's no reason that he would do those things, but actually there is a reason. And it's that alcoholism is a disease and he has it.
I want to just sort of clarify. I think there are very complicated reasons that he would do that.
Sure.
But in the way that he did it, why would a father in this circumstance reiterate this betrayal in his daughter's home?
Yeah.
Some part of him has to know that he is setting up a situation where he's going to get caught and that it is going to send him into exile. Of course he hasn't responded. He's ashamed. He's horribly ashamed of what he's done. And that shame was what led him to the gin bottle in the first place, and it's probably what's keeping him from reaching out to her.
I agree. You know, and I think, too, the most powerful part of this letter is that here's somebody who's actually done the right thing.
Right.
You know, she's protecting her boundaries. She, you know, in a loving but firm way, asked her father to leave as soon as she understood that there was this trouble over this. You know, this is something she's been dealing with for a long time. And so I think when you're at that place in your life, you know, I would say to her, first of all, you know, keep honoring those boundaries. Keep remembering that the life you have to protect is your own, in your family's life, the family you made. And try to remain open while protecting yourself. I think my greatest consolation when I've been at that kind of breaking point with people in my life who essentially have, you know, diseases such as alcoholism, you know, that really dictate in great measure the kinds of relationships we can have with them. My consolation has been literature. Yeah. Mary Carr's memoir, Lit, you know, it really tells the story of her struggle with alcoholism. Right. Raymond Carver's short stories. The short story Where I'm Calling From, I think might be the greatest piece of literature about alcoholism I've ever read. He spent a lifetime struggling with alcohol.
Drinking a Love Story by Carolyn Knapp, one of the books that the most deeply takes you into the dependence and what people find in alcohol. They're not just running into their own ruin. They're escaping into something that becomes a powerful compulsion that they're helpless before.
Yeah. And I think, you know, this daughter, this letter writer, has every right to be angry and tired and over it. But she also, I think, healing will come through having compassion and understanding that his struggle is not, has nothing to do with how much he loves her at all. It has to do with his disease. It's yeah. between him and himself. It's not about her or her daughter.
Yeah, I mean, one way of saying it is it's not about how much he loves her. It's about how much he hates himself
exactly.
at the moment. We want parents to be people who are idealized figures and are strong and so forth. I think sometimes the pressure of that on a father who maybe is feeling darker feelings that he doesn't want to reveal to his family, when you're trying to maintain that kind of strength and authority and you really don't feel it, you don't have the internal mechanisms to really support the burden of being the breadwinner and the strong father and whatever else this guy was carrying around, in a certain way, she has to acknowledge her father's pushing her away right now.
Mm-hmm.
And the only way that he's going to come back and be allowed back in is if he's ready for it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's tough because he might not be. It's possible that he won't get it together or that he'll earn her trust back and then reach for the liquor cabinet again. I hope not, though. And I think that she strikes me as the sort of person who's really quite aware of how fragile and tenuous not just this relationship is, but her own father's happiness is.
She's the child of an alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
This is the system she's grown up in, the psychological mindset she's had all of her life. And part of being a child of an alcoholic is that you're always having to consider their needs, anticipate their behavior.
Yeah.
And one of the beautiful things about growing up is you do get to free yourself of those family systems that did not serve us well. So she gets to change her life. She can't change her father's life. She doesn't get to decide whether he gets sober or not,
right?
Whether he stays strong in his sobriety or not. She doesn't get to decide whether he lies to her or is a great grandfather
right.
to her granddaughter. But what she does get to decide is who she gets to be as a mother and as a daughter. And I think it's really important to remember that.
Yeah.
That, you know, even as an adult, you get to decide who you are as a son and who you are as a daughter if you still have parents who are alive. And what I would really encourage Tired and Confused to do is to be proactive. I think sometimes we feel the most frustrated and powerless when we are letting somebody else sort of run the boat. You know, here her father is visiting. He starts drinking. Everything that happened in that week was essentially brought about by her father's decisions and actions.
Right.
She uncovered his deceit. He drank, you know, all of this drama. You know, what I would recommend that she does is not wait for her father to call her up, not wait for her father to get in touch from rehab or wherever he is, but, you know, write him a letter, an email, a phone call, go meet him in person, whatever she thinks is best.
Right.
And say to him everything she has to say.
Right.
I love you. I know you love me. Okay, those are two things she said in this letter. That's the ground upon which everything can be built, that all possibility resides. I love you, and I know you love me, and I want you to be a good father to me and a good grandfather to my daughter, but you can only be that if you're sober.
Yep, absolutely. She should write that letter, but without the expectation. I mean, the one thing that we could say is worth doing is realizing if she's still really angry and resentful at her father for what he has done previously, and she hasn't forgiven him for that, as I think the end of the letter is suggesting, well, that's the work that she has to do,
right.
is to figure out, even if it's not going to be returned, even if he's not going to be able to remain sober and come back into her life, that's almost a separate issue from, can you forgive him for his weaknesses, his mm-hmm. transgressions?
Well, and I think unforgiveness, you know, it's not just something we do once. It sounds to me like she's actually done an awful lot of forgiveness over the years.
Yeah.
And what's happened here is, you know, this experience with the granddaughter, you know, with her newborn baby girl, it's reignited her anger. That doesn't mean that, you know, she has to go back to, you know, step one. It's just that she has to forgive him again. It's an ongoing process. And I think part of that, you know, to me, at root, forgiveness is about acceptance and letting go. And I think that part of that might be, you know, she mentions this financial assistance she's received from her father. And I think that I would ask Tired and Confused to really examine, you know, what a role that plays in her ability to have a little more distance from her father. Maybe the best thing for her would be in setting the boundaries, the emotional boundaries she has with her dad, to maybe set some new financial boundaries
yeah.
and actually not accept his financial help. You know, there's something incredibly liberating about being independent from the people who cause us pain. You know, it equalizes them in a way.
Yeah, yeah.
And
absolutely.
So, you know, I think there's so much light and strength and good here. And tired and confused. You know, I'll speak for both of us. It's so sad. You know, we have, I think when we have an experience like a new baby, you know, life begins again. You feel like, okay, everything can be good. All of those mistakes, you know, I made in the past, all those mistakes my parents or my family of origin made in the past, we can begin anew. We can be that ideal family that we've carried around in our heads. And then we find we can't be.
The well is poisoned.
Things come crashing down around us. But I hope that Tired and Confused will remember just how much light really is in this letter. And we wish you all well. And congratulations on your new baby girl.
Yes. Congratulations. Enjoy when they're little like that. They're so dear.
The beast in me is caged by frail and fragile bars, restless by day and by night, rants and rages at the stars. God help the beast in me.
What do you feel you've created in your life? Is the family you've created like the family you came from?
I mean, it's sort of to be determined, isn't it? But I can certainly see the ways in which, you know, sort of who I came from, for better or worse, the flaws and the beauties and the strengths of my parents are absolutely directly in me. I can't do anything about it. We can't just choose one part of our families.
Yeah. And I think there's a third family. There's the origin family. There's the created family. And then there's the ideal family we all carry around inside of us.
Well, see, I was going to guess Sly and the Family Stone, but this is an even better
Sly
one.
And the right. Well, there is Sly and the... So there's a fourth family.
So there's a fourth family.
So if I were growing up in the same town as you, I might have decided that you were this ideal family simply by virtue of the fact that, you know, your parents are still married to each
That's
other.
That's right. That's right.
You know, you were basically middle class. You know, you didn't have some of the economic struggles that my family had. And so I would look at your family from the outside and say, this is the perfect family. This is the ideal family.
Right.
Did you also have in your mind the ideal family?
I think everybody does.
Yeah.
And I think you're absolutely right that we sort of see what's inside. And a lot of times it's very direct. I would go to kids' houses where there was a certain plenitude that was, I felt like wasn't at home. For me, it had to do with a certain kind of emotional and psychological willingness to really be honest and to accept weakness and doubt, right? Here's a funny thing, Cheryl. When I was a kid, I was terrified of sleeping over at people's houses. And only when I would leave, you know, I would get so anxious, I'd have to be brought home. But what was interesting is when I was at those other kids' houses, I had this dream in my head. I had this idea in my head that there was this warm house and all my family was there and that I had a home there and it was comfortable and beautiful and nurturing. And that's not the house I returned to. I had to leave it in order to sort of hold on to that idealized
right.
space. But the truth of it is that I'd brought all the doubt and acrimony and all the things that were blocking us from really loving and supporting one another with me to that other house. And only by leaving it could I kind of create this fake idealized thing that I yearned for.
Uh-huh.
The truth is I was yearning for it all the time. We all yearn for it.
But the fact that there's chaos, it's strife and struggle, and that doesn't mean that there's something sinister at its core. That's what real love looks like. You know,
right.
maybe that ideal family that we've been carrying around in our minds all this while, it never existed.
You're never gonna be that far away from home.
So, Cheryl, I want to read a letter that is, in fact, in response to one of our previous letters where we're talking about the struggle around whether to have a third child or not. And we talked in that episode a lot about how sacred and wonderful being a parent is. It's the most important and special thing that you can do and so forth.
That we've ever done.
That's right.
We've that's also true. Found parenthood to be a major
pain in the butt. Exactly. But that's for another show.
That's right, another show.
So the question comes in. So, Sugars, what about those of us who don't want kids? I'm nearly 31. For the first time in my adult life, I'm in a loving and healthy relationship. I am thrilled to, among other things, find a partner who, like me, doesn't ever want to be a parent, ever. I realize I would make a good mom. I realize because so many well-intentioned people have told me so. Yet that isn't reason enough for me to create offspring. I asked my friend who knows she wants babies, "How did you know you wanted kids?" She just did. It was an innate inner core feeling she had. She asked how I knew I didn't want them. It's just a sense and a strong feeling, or maybe perhaps it's the realization I don't have the feeling she has, the feeling of wanting to be a parent. So, Sugars, I just want to know, one, if I never become a parent, is it true? Will I really miss out on the most amazing thing? Two, this is scary. Is it possible I am mistaken / making a mistake by not having kids? Is my gut that I don't want to be a mom incorrect? Three, am I cursed to a lifetime of having to explain my choice to be childless? In sum, what is a person to do in a world that holds parenthood on such a pedestal? How are the childless by choice supposed to actualize ourselves and find our own perfect sacred places of growth and wonder that is apparently part of this parenthood deal and the thing you find when you have kids? Thank you, signed Auntie Forever, Sarah in Minnesota.
One of the saddest things to me about this conversation that I think we've only really as a culture recently started to have,
right,
you know, finally saying, listen, you're not a selfish or terrible person if you don't decide to be a parent.
Right.
You know, I mean, I just want to be so clear about this fact that there's no relationship between a meaningful life and being a parent. It is true that most people find parenthood to be extraordinarily meaningful. And it's also true that it's perfectly valid and actually a rather grand idea that not everyone should be a parent. And then what's wonderful about that is something else gets to be the big thing.
That's right. And when I think about the big point in my life where things change very dramatically, and not for the better, just for the more complicated, is the moment when I had kids. And I sort of do look back, and I want to cop to this to you, you know, Sarah in Minnesota, Auntie Forever. I think that as a parent, sometimes I'm so stressed out and I'm so overwhelmed by the feelings of responsibility and guilt and anxiety and all the rest of it, that I do get resentful of people who don't have kids. And I think it manifests itself in a certain kind of unspoken snobbery or a certain kind of attitude of looking down my nose at people who've decided to not burden themselves in this way.
Hmm.
And I mean, I would never say it out loud, but I feel it inwardly.
You just did.
And I just did. I and other parents can send out that vibe. And I think it's especially malignant and insidious in relation to women. Because it's not just parenthood, but specifically motherhood. After all, guys who are wandering around who decide to not have kids, maybe there's some judgments that are made, but I think it's far less than the judgments that are made against women for really actually just not feeling that desire to have a child.
I'm really interested in this thing that you just said,
because
yes. I sort of thought, well, do I feel that way? And I have to say that, I mean, when I think of when those feelings that you speak of have risen in me, you know, when I'm working really hard and going nonstop. And, you know, I'll be talking to a friend who isn't a parent. You know, we're just talking about our level of exhaustion. And sometimes I'll think, and great, you know, when you go home at the end of the day, you don't then have children waiting there
right.
to be fed and put to bed. And, you know, and I think, well, you know, the inherent problem is that it's not a competition.
Right.
That we don't have to decide, like, who has the easy life, who has the hard life, who sacrificed more, who has a deeper life.
Well, it's tough. You know, we call it, you know, and Aaron and I talk about it as the suffering pageant. You know, who's suffering more?
Right.
Who's working harder?
So let's bring somebody else into this conversation. Obviously, both of us did decide to become parents.
Yes.
I have two kids. You have three. A writer who we both adore and admire, Elizabeth Gilbert. She's written about her decision, much like Sarah in Minnesota, to not be a mother.
I'm such a huge fan of Liz Gilbert, especially her fiction. I think The Signature of All Things, the new novel that just came out, is such a beautiful book. And I also want to say, as we welcome her, that I get from her a wonderful Christmas card. And it's always like her and just say her wonderful husband, and they're always like in some wonderful place.
I'm
always
well-sexed, well-rested.
They always look well-sexed.
Well-fed.
Exactly. And again, it's like, it's that thing you do. You gaze at the train going the other direction, you go, oh, wow. And then you try very hard not to be bitter because it's Liz Gilbert.
So we're going to call her up.
Yes. Hello.
Hi, friend.
Liz, we've been talking. Steve Almond receives your Christmas card, and I do not.
Oh, I knew that was going to get
so
you.
This is so not fair.
Oh, my God. Okay,
yeah.
But just to be clear, it is not totally, completely Steve Almond who gets a Christmas card.
Yeah,
it's
in
Steve
fact,
Almond's
I...
daughter
thank
who
you.
Gets a Christmas card from
yes.
me. Which brings us to our question, actually.
Yes.
Yeah.
I have to say, this is a serious question, and it's an understandably confusing one. And it's a question that I've spent a lot of time thinking about, and it's a question that drove me kind of to the brink of madness. There is a certain kind of existential calmness that can come in a way from having kids in terms of making your life have meaning, right? It's
right.
a very real way for your life to have meaning. When you have that crisis of what is it all about, you can look at your kids and say,
"That's what,
oh,
it's, all
this is what it's all about, right?
Yeah.
I'm part of the cycle of life. You know, this is what I came from. This is what I'm passing on." And that can give you a certain reassurance in your soul that it's no joke to step away from. You know, to step away from that means you have to find other ways to find that sense of meaning in your life, because you're not going to have that answer. So these are questions I struggled with when I was 30 and I was married, and I'd gotten married with the assumption that we would have kids. And then I had a total nervous breakdown when I turned 30 because I didn't want to. And, you know, all of society pushes you to want to, and I was on the path to want to, but the problem was I just didn't want to. And I ended up doing something that was really important. I ended up spending probably a year asking every single woman I met, no matter what her age was, no matter what her situation was, what her experience was with either having children or not having had children. And because I came at them from such a vulnerable and confused place about it, they were really candid with me. And I heard hundreds of stories. I heard from women who said it was the best thing they had ever done. I heard from women who looked on the outside to me like terrific mothers and happy families, who confessed that if they had it all over to do again, they wouldn't have kids.
Yeah.
I heard from women who were childless and regretted it deeply. You know, there was just this huge, huge, huge variety of experience. And I think what I finally realized was that I'm looking for one answer. I'm looking for one truth. And there isn't one answer or one truth. There are multiple truths for every woman's life, and none of these women can answer this question for me. I'm going to have to come to my own truth about this. And my own truth was that every single molecule in my body said, don't do this. Mm-hmm. And to have denied that would have been to have lived in somebody else's truth, to have lived in somebody else's dreams, to have lived in somebody else's expectations, and you don't serve anybody when you do that.
Yeah.
And so eventually I just had to stand in that truth and speak it out loud and stop overanalyzing it in a way.
Right.
And just say, the answer appears to be no.
Right. I think that women especially, but just in general, people are sent the message that, almost like with love, that there's just either you know or you don't. And in Liz's case, you're quite fortunate to have a very clear sense of this and to be able to, after really anguishing over it for a time, say, it's clear cut. This is just not what I want to do with my life. I want to do other things with my life. For, I think, Sarah in Minnesota, what you're struggling with is questioning that gut. It sounds to us from her letter as if she really doesn't want to have kids, and she's found somebody who wants to have a loving relationship with who agrees with that. And she has to maybe trust that, but it's also true that her feelings might shift. And she has to be open to that possibility as well, at least at the age of 31. People evolve and they change. If you had talked to my wife, Erin, at 24, 25, she would have said, I have no interest in children. And she might have even said the same thing at, you know, 29 or 30 because of, for whatever reason. But as it turns out, she was profoundly interested in having that experience in her life. And it kind of took her by surprise. I'm just making an argument that as well as she can, Sarah in Minnesota, you have to really do the work that Liz is talking about in terms of really examining not what other people say the solution is, but what you feel. Is this the beginning of a nagging doubt that's trying to tell you something, or is this really something that's being put on you by a culture that does, as she writes, I think quite eloquently, put parenthood up on a pedestal and essentially pressure people to feel that their lives aren't full enough or rich enough if they don't have kids?
Well, one of the things that Sarah asks, and I want you to address this, Liz, that she says, well, what replaces that? If I'm not a mother, what do I have? And my answer to that is like, all the
rest
of life, you know, there's so much. But you know, in a real way, though, I would love to hear what you have to say about that, Liz.
Okay, first of all, I have to say that it's interesting, and I'm not criticizing it, it's just the way the world works, that you have to defend why you don't have children,
right,
but you don't have to defend why you do have them.
Right.
Which I think is really interesting, because I actually think the bigger decision is to have them.
Yeah.
But that's another subject. You will always be questioned for why you don't have kids. And I'm lucky because I have this airtight alibi, which is that I have a vocation, right? I'm a writer. I love my work. You know, I want to devote myself to it. I'm an artist. It demands my hours. I travel a lot. That's an easy way for me to shut down that conversation, because people are like, oh, okay, cool. I get that.
Right.
But my feeling is, you should be allowed to not have a kid if you work at Dairy Queen and you don't want to have a kid. I don't believe that you're obliged to replace it with something that society will consider to be of equal value or contribution and say, there, can I get a pass? I don't think that's necessary. You can just say, I want to do it. So I'm going to trust the stuff that I do want and follow that and create my path down that line.
And maybe the question for you, Sarah, in Minnesota, is the simple question, what do you desire?
Yeah.
Not what do you feel guilty because you don't desire, but what do you actively want? What gives you meaning in your life?
And as someone who, in fact, did work at a Dairy Queen in Minnesota, no less, I worked at the Dairy Queen in McGregor, Minnesota.
Oh, yeah.
I was still, my life was still full of meaning and experience. And it's interesting to hear you say that because so much of my own ambivalence was actually about just that, that I wasn't lacking anything. Frankly, for me, just the decision to get pregnant to begin with, I was pretty tortured about it. And I was acutely aware of what I might be giving up by deciding to become a mother. So the whole time I was pregnant with my first child, I was thinking, I really hope this isn't the biggest mistake of my life.
Which meant you were being conscious about it, which is really the only thing I think we can ask of ourselves, is that we make our choices as consciously as we can.
That's right.
Because it is tragic, and I can say that in my family and, you know, in Aaron's family, I know of mothers who deeply did not want to be mothers and who are deeply ambivalent about motherhood, and that is the crime that dare not speak its name in our culture, is maternal ambivalence. And it absolutely oppresses women who instinctively don't want to have to take on those duties and responsibilities to have to do it. And they do a lousy job and, you know, they feel terrible about themselves, or they do a good job, but it doesn't feel good enough because something inside of them has had to ultimately betray their gut.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Steve, for saying that. It's so great because what I remembered when I was interviewing when I got this was this woman who I think of as being one of the best mothers I've ever met, who has, you know, one of the most successful families you could imagine, beautiful, loving, gracious, successful adult children who she's very close with. And she blew my mind because she said, if I had it all over to do again, I wouldn't do any of this because the cost was too great. Honestly, I love my children, but it was not worth what it took out of me. Mm-hmm. And I was like, thank you for saying that to me, because no one's allowed to say that, you know? And that's her truth. And it's not like she's not in a mental hospital over it. It's just that she just very candidly said, God, this cost a lot for me.
Right.
And I kind of wish I had those years back. And may I also just throw one more thing in? I caution people about having children because they're trying to avoid later regretting not having children. That's not a good enough reason, I think.
That's really interesting. Because I, you know, as I listen to you, I agree with you. I see that point. I see that argument. And yet I will say I'm really happy that I decided to become a mother. And one of the things that helped me come to that decision was actually thinking of my future self. You know, if a magic genie had come along when I was 34 and said, you know, I promise you that you'll be fertile in 10 years and you can wait until you're 45 to start having kids, I would have said, thank you. But I also felt like I think I do want to do this thing. And even though I don't really want to do it like right this minute, I'm going to do it. And it was thinking about what I, you know, wished I would have 10 years down the road, which is to have a couple kids.
So that tipped the scale for you.
Yeah, it did. The future self tipped the scale. But I think that's the beauty of life. And this is the embrace of life. Like, I love that story you just told about the friend who has the gracious, beautiful children and who says, if I could do it all over again, I wouldn't do it. And, you know, what I love is the possibility that we're wise enough and smart enough that we can embrace that complexity and know that she's not saying that she doesn't absolutely love her children and that she's not saying she doesn't treasure the many years they've had together. She's saying she can envision a different life for herself, and maybe going back in time, it's the road she would have taken, you know? It doesn't obliterate what's beautiful about the road she did take.
Right.
And I think that we can say, listen to Liz and think about what you want in the moment, and listen to Cheryl and think about your future self, and maybe put both of those things into the pot and stir. And in what you can come up with is maybe, you know, a few different wisdoms that will lead you in the right direction.
You know, I truly hope so. And I hope that my hope for everybody always is that whatever decisions they make about their lives, they can reconcile to a point of peace and calmness about it, you know? And when people say to me, or I hear people say, You'll never know the experience of love that I know from having kids. I say, you are totally right. I would never question that in a million years. I can't even begin to imagine it because I've never had that encounter and I've never had that experience. But I also decided a long time ago that I don't have to have every human experience that there is in this one lifetime.
Right.
And there are certain experiences that I've had that other people can never imagine. We can't imagine each other's lives. We can only dream up our own.
Liz, thank you so much for spending time with us. I think I speak for everybody, Cheryl and myself certainly, and probably all our listeners, in saying whenever you want to drop by, you're welcome.
Oh, thank you. And whenever you want to give me a call, I'm always happy to hear from you guys. And your podcast is lovely.
Thanks so much.
Bye.
Sarah in Minnesota. Head by the wonderful Dairy Queen in McGregor, Minnesota.
That's
get a
right.
soft serve cone and, you know, sit on a bench in the sunshine and think, what are the sacred places of growth and wonder that I want in my life? What are the things that you do want to
right.
be a part of your life?
I think that's great advice for Sarah. And the piece that I'd add, Sarah, is that, you know, whatever path you choose will be a good one. You know, if you decide to become a parent, probably being a parent will be one of the most important and meaningful and profound experiences of your life.
Right.
You'll learn a lot. You'll see yourself in a new way. You'll love in a new way. And if you don't become a parent, we can't predict what else it'll be. Life is full of all kinds of things.
Right.
But parenthood, you know, it takes up a lot of space and something has to go. There are things that I have missed in the last 10 years because I was so focused on being a mother. I did a whole bunch of other things in the last 10 years too, and they were important to me. So, you know, I just want to say, take a deep breath and trust yourself, trust your gut on this.
Right. Find your desire. That most amazing thing that for some people is having kids and being a parent, for you, it might be something else.
That's right. And good luck.
Good luck.
So is it any wonder that I
Dear Sugar Radio is produced by WBUR in Boston.
We are produced and edited by Lisa Tobin.
Engineering and production help by Jim Brumberg. And you can write to us at dearsugarradio@gmail.com.
And also remember to listen and subscribe on iTunes. We are grateful for all your support, all your letters, all your ears.
And fancy free and